Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity to continue the argument on behalf of my client. I want to go back to something, and Justice Pierre-Louis, this specifically addresses an issue that you raised before, and I want to give you a citation. It's the, I'm going to butcher this name, Merkides case. It's this court, 153 NJ 117 at 136.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
153 NJ 117 136, it's cited in the briefs. Developing a project and directing that it be completed within a certain time frame and within certain specifications do not constitute interference with the project and remain within the, quote, general supervisory power over the result to be accomplished rather than the means of that accomplishment, end quote. And I bring that quote to Your Honor's attention and to the court's attention because even in the event that the court looks at this and is trying to find a way to mesh the common law under the Walczak line of cases, the Tarabokia line of cases with the Alloway line of cases, this quote, which relies on that type of analysis, supports the idea that in this case, my client as a developer does not have any potential for responsibility as a matter of law. And so I wanted to just make that quote clear. Wanted to return to the OSHA discussion.
Before you do that, now that you open this avenue, would you mind clarifying a few more points about the relationship and the roles of each of the players here? The 2013 contract between Port Authority and NYNJ Link, is that in the record?
It is part of the appendix. At least there's a, my recollection is that there is a six-page summary of certain aspects of it that includes reference back that a contractor would be hired to do the work.
How does that contract refer to NYNJ Link?
The developer.
And only as a developer?
Yes.
Sorry, and you say this contract specifically says a general contractor will be hired to do the work?
It doesn't use that term, a contractor.
But we a contractor.
Only, but doesn't we only, use the term general contractor.
We only have a summary. We don't have the contract itself.
Again, I apologize for if I'm incorrect, but that's my recollection that there was a summary of an aspect of it in there.
I'm not sure we have the full contract either. This isn't a trick question.
I'm obligated to know the record, and that's what I believe to be the answer, but I want to qualify. But what I can say with certainty is that the contract that governs the relationship between KWM and New York, New Jersey Link is in full part of the appendix.
And what does that contract say about the particular roles? Does it assign labels to both sides? And what are they?
Yes, Chief Justice. We're designated in every respect as the developer, beginning in the beginning of the contract and all the way through. And they are designated as, KWM is designated as the quote-unquote contractor. And all the obligations that you would ordinarily find that would be associated with being a general contractor, including those as it might relate to job site safety, are all contained in that contract and create those obligations as to them.
Is there a standard meaning for the term developer?
There's a Black's Law Dictionary meaning for it, but it is...
Does it extend beyond mere investing?
Yes, it does. Because investing... Developing a project, it includes taking all the steps that are necessary, and I hate to use the same word to define the word, but to bring the development to a conclusion, and that could include any number of different things, but does not include construction. It includes coordination, you know, hiring of a contractor. It can include coordination of the bids. It could include a whole myriad of things that have to do with the steps that have to be taken before the project can even be put out to bid. And it varies, but it is not, the definition does not encompass those things that are ordinarily considered to be the responsibility of a general contractor, including overseeing the job site safety for the work to the extent that that may find its way into a contract between a general contractor and a developer or between a general contractor and subcontractors.
So it doesn't involve constructing. Earlier, we spoke about the responsibilities that NYNJ Link had. The trial court stated the responsibilities. The CEO of NYNJ Link stated the responsibilities in his deposition. It seems like designing, financing, constructing is all part of those responsibilities. So what is the constructing?
Nothing more than hiring the contractor. That's it. Designing the project and hiring a contractor, knowing what the design is.
So using the phrase constructing as one of NYNJ Link's responsibilities does not mean constructing.
It certainly does not. And on the facts of this case, it did not, which is really more important, frankly. You know, if you look at the cases like the Muhammad case and other cases that I've cited, including the Maya Caritas case, whatever label you may want to put on it, depending on which of the analysis the court undertakes to use to analyze the conduct of NYNJ Link, they were not overseeing the construction. That's not disputed. They were not on the job site overseeing safety. They were not hiring, training employees. They were not setting safety standards. They were not, they didn't have a site safety coordinator. They didn't have a competent person on site. Like all the things that if you look at the cases that you have available to you and the factors that courts have looked at in trying to determine when and if a duty exists, and if so, to what extent, all of those typical things are there. None of those things are here.
So you're telling us that you hired KMW to build the bridge. Did you hire anyone else for that?
No. No, they were a joint venture made up of three construction contractors. And I said this at the beginning, but I can't belabor it enough, I guess. The appellant repeatedly characterized KWN as the general contractor. So you don't have to take my word for it. Where is that?
Correct.
I mean,
you mean in the briefing below?
Yes.
In the complaint, where specifically should we look?
As it's most critical for this record, in the briefs to the trial court, in the briefs to the appellate division, and in the petition for certification before this court. The law that was argued is law that this court could look at and decide we want to address this issue of the interplay between those two things in the context of a general contractor. But none of the facts that were presented, and even the merits petition, if you look at it carefully, it's very carefully worded and very well written. It never defines us as the general contractor because it can't.
Counsel, you know, again, appellant also characterizes your client as the general contractor in the complaint.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Appellant also characterizes your client as the general contractor in the complaint.
Certainly, I would acknowledge that that was done at oral argument.
It
may well have been in the complaint, and if that's something I overlooked, I apologize. But in terms of the manner in which the issue has actually been addressed by the court on the substantive duty that might be owed, it was always acknowledged in every paper that was submitted that we were the developer and that KWM was the general contractor. So, like we're arguing this here, you have the right to rely on the position that's being taken at when the issues that are before the court are being decided, and that's the position that was taken consistently in every instance.
Let's look at it from the other end. If you know, and Mr. Confucione perhaps can help us as well, did KMW hire subcontractors?
No.
So there's no subcontractor in this case?
None. There's no evidence in the record that they hired any subcontractors, but as it relates to the work that was involved in this incident, there is no indication that anyone was other than an employee of that joint venture.
I understand, but subcontractors traditionally don't hire their own subcontractors, correct?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It's certainly true that there are plenty of times where you could have a subcontractor that's going to be involved in the foundation work, and they hire an excavator to do the excavation that's part of the building the foundation. So the sub subs to somebody else, and then another sub does the rebar and foundation work. So that complicated level of relationship exists on a regular basis on construction projects.
So in your opposition to the petition for certification on page 3, in describing the procedural history, defendants argue that you moved for summary judgment in the trial court because defendants weren't responsible for the actions of plaintiff's coworker, which caused the accident. Further, NYNJ Link was not responsible for the actions of their subcontractor. Who is that referring to? Or what entity is that referring to? That's page 2 of the brief in opposition for petition for certification. What is that referring to if there is no subcontractor in this case?
Well, I, if I'm looking at the same part Your Honor was, it says / independent contractor.
No, this is page...
Page 2?
2. Brief in opposition?
Yes, I have that before me.
Dated July 10th, 2025. So it's page two, the
paragraph. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the petition for cert, the merits brief before
okay, this court. Okay, no. I was looking at the opposition.
I don't have that before me, Your Honor, but I will say again that regardless of how that was worded in there, there is no subcontractor that this record discloses that has anything to do with the work that was involved at the time of the accident.
But it was noted by counsel for defendants at the time, so that's why I'm asking.
Fair enough. But I don't.
We've been talking about how the representations and the parties have been characterized by plaintiff and in different briefs. So here it seems defense counsel in opposition to the petition for certification is making the representation that, look, we move for summary judgment in the trial court because NYNJ Link is not responsible for the actions of their subcontractor. So it would be interesting to know exactly
I think
who that subcontractor is that was being referred to.
I think maybe that the use of the term subcontractor there is not the most artful word that could have been chosen. And I believe, because the only facts in the record that would be available support that, as I acknowledged at the outset, there is a DNC component, design and construction component, to the agreement between Port Authority and NJ Link. And then that work was contracted to the general contractor. And I guess in the most technical way you could look at that, that could be a subcontract. But I understood the court's question to be whether once the work was contracted to KWM, did it subcontract any of that work to anyone else? And to my knowledge, the answer to that is not based on any facts in this record, and certainly not as it applies to all the allegations involving the accident that forms the subject matter of the lawsuit.
Oh, yes, that was the chief's question. Like, did KWM hire any subcontractors? Were there any subcontractors? Your answer was no, so that's why I would like to know
who the
subcontractor is.
Again, I think they're not referring to a quote-unquote subcontractor. I think that is a perhaps less than artful way of referring to the decision to take that portion of this 40-year agreement that included design and construction and contract with another entity to do that. Thereby, I guess you could use the term subcontracting it, but that doesn't define the relationship between New Jersey Link and the project. At no point in time did they ever assume responsibilities in the real world in terms of the work that was done out there to actually construct the project. They were never there for anything other than looking at the progress of the project to make sure it was done in accordance with the design specifications and within budget.
Does that matter for purposes of the legal test? Because I just looked back at Carvalho versus Toll Brothers and Developers from 1996, a case of this court where the general contractor had already settled the case and the plaintiff was suing the engineer at this point. And the legal standards applied to the engineer were the same that you're saying apply only to a general contractor. So if it turns out NYNJ is not actually the general contractor and KWM is not actually the subcontractor, does that matter for purposes of the legal test if in Carvalho, the party that was found liable ultimately was an engineer and not a general contractor at all?
I think it depends on the purpose of the court's analysis. In the most general sense, the question was broadly a general contractor. So I'm addressing it in that context, number one. Number two, I'm addressing
from the way that we stated it in the order granting certification or something else.
I think that's fair, Your Honor. I mean, it framed a question, and it was a general question. And as probably been clear from my argument, when I first read the question, it was a little bit, of uncertainty on my part, understanding what the status was that seemed to be acknowledged by all parties of my client as a developer. But that doesn't answer your direct question. I want to answer it directly. In this case, what matters, if you look at it in the, I'm going to call it the alloy approach, what matters is things that generally apply to whether you find a duty like under Laszlo and Hopkins and all that. And part of it is the relationship of the parties and the opportunity to prevent the harm and all those types of things. In this case, because they were the developer, and I gave you the other quotation from another of this court's cases as to developer just making sure something's done in accordance with the plans and specifications doesn't rise beyond that general supervision, even under Alloway. But in the case of the engineer, there were two elements that were, I think, critically important in that case. One, the responsibility of the engineer did include responsibility over the trenches, including potentially the safety in the way that the trenches were handled, whether they were used, whether they used trench boxes, which that was the allegation they hadn't done in any of those trenches, whether they stepped them back. And in addition to that, more specifically, the facts that allowed for the court to determine that it was fair to impose a duty was that the engineer was on site on a regular basis, and part of what he was doing on site was observing the trenches, and in addition to that, was aware that several of the trenches had collapsed prior to that time frame. And so those factors, even under the Alloway approach to things, gave the court the basis to believe that on those specific facts there should be a duty. And it kind of goes to what I was addressing before, which is the bottom-up approach that has been taken by this court in the Walczak line of cases, where you place the greatest duty, if not the exclusive duty, on the party that is controlling the actual work, which makes common sense in the real world, because you're always in the best position to try to address anything that might go wrong. The argument that has been woven through Bortz, Meter, Kane, Alloway, and Fernandez on some basis is the idea that you should take a top-down approach and make the general contractor the repository of all obligations as to safety. That approach is not consistent with OSHA's approach for the reasons that we've already discussed. OSHA doesn't impose obligations on anyone other than an employer under the General Duty Clause, Section 5A1 of OSHA, and the standards that we've articulated that are relied upon to suggest otherwise only have to do with the federal government. And I want to address some terms that were used. The federal government, and let me give you an analogy, looking at an environmental context, the way the federal government and even our state government is set up when you have those kind of situations, you can go after everybody. There's no limitation on what you can do. Nobody can say, no, it's not me, it's them. If you were involved, you can go after them. The federal government has the power to make those kind of decisions. And in section subparts A and B of OSHA, for federally funded federal projects, they've done that. The word prime contractor, which Your Honor read, is used in that. That has a specific defined meaning within OSHA in the definition section. You will never find the word general contractor anywhere, even in that part, let alone in subpart C, which was what applies to private employment. And if you look further down in that section, the only sentence I omitted, it actually goes into the idea of, even though somebody may be called a subcontractor, it kind of teases out the idea that when you're doing a federal job, they can go after everybody and anybody, and everybody's going to be responsible, and nobody's going to say we're not and delegate it to somebody else. And that's a decision that the federal government has made. And at one point in time, our state, through legislation, made that same decision. And that's what's articulated in Bortz. But they abandoned that when OSHA went into effect. And so there is no basis in OSHA or any basis under New Jersey law to extend the idea of a prime contractor or general contractor, if you want to interchange those. Because I want to be clear, a prime contractor, if you're on a site and you're a developer or you are a construction manager, which is another term of art, where you may oversee parts of the project, but the contracts to do the work aren't entered into by you like they might be with a GC. They're entered into by the owner. A prime contractor, you can have 3, 4, 5 prime contractors on a job site, one to do demolition, Councilman, one to do construction.
I'm sorry to try to
get too far afield. Fair enough.
We're almost at 20 minutes in the afternoon. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on very briefly? And are there any questions?
Yes.
I just have a very brief question. Councilor, the developer factually could assume responsibilities, could assume a degree of control that would make the Alloway or common law analysis appropriate here, right? Just calling them the developer or characterizing them as the developer doesn't mean they could not put them into a position in which, for instance, they have assumed a degree of control in which that test would be pertinent as to whether there's a potential claim against the developer.
I can't reasonably dispute that, Justice Hoffman, and I think that's the reason that when I went over the Muhammad case, New Jersey Transit was the owner, and the duty was analyzed with them, even though they weren't the general contractor. and the factors that were present in that case that led this court to determine that there was no duty as a matter of law are identical to the factors that were present in this case. And in addition to that, the quote from this court's opinion in Makaritis, whether they could do that or not, there is no evidence in the record that they did, and all the evidence, in fact, is to the contrary. And I'm trying to do this very succinctly. There were a number of public policy arguments that were made that I just want to address as quickly as I can. An argument is made regarding the availability of insurance. That ignores the realities of the insurance market in New Jersey and the challenges that there are for general contractors to get that work as compared to other states where there are broader duties and the shrinking market that exists to that. It also ignores the fact that subcontractors also have insurance on project. It also ignores the fact that subcontractors are equally incentivized to make sure that their workers work safely because they're required to provide workers' comp insurance. And the mods for that that determine the premium, which is a huge driver, are number one, your payroll, and number two, your loss history. And so every time they don't prevent an accident, there's a loss history, you see all those signs, 752 safe days. There's a reason that that's being tracked. It's because it affects those things. So that argument really doesn't apply any differently to a general contractor than it does to a subcontractor. It also ignores the impact that a general duty, as is being urged by the plaintiff, would have on residential construction. I know that the argument here was commercial construction, but it's really not an appropriate way to look at it, respectfully. It's a question of whether you have a multi-employer site or not. You could be have, you know, fill-in-the-blank developer building affordable housing, which is, you know, tracks and tracks of homes, and they have more contractors on the job site with a general contractor than you would on a typical commercial project. And think about the impact on in our state where it's already a strain to try to get those homes built if you were to place the kind of duty that's being urged on contractors that could be involved in that type of work.
Council, we're at about 50 minutes for your argument. Can I ask you to please sum up?
Yes, Your Honor. Respectfully, it's submitted that no matter how this court looks at the duty question, the facts in this case under either analysis don't allow for anything other than affirming the trial court and appellate division's well-reasoned decisions as it relates to this work. The top-down approach that's being urged is not supported by the law. It's not supported by OSHA. It doesn't recognize the realities of practice. And I'll point out, and then I'll conclude. This court has many opportunities to visit this. I mean, again, I have another case in the pipeline where the argument's being made, not only is there a non-delegable duty, but the jury should have been told that, and the lawyer should be permitted to tell the jurors that during arguments. This has a wide-ranging impact that depends on a lot of very fact-sensitive ideas. If the court is looking to potentially revisit the standard and move away from the general understanding that's subject to certain exceptions, a general contractor or other entity like a landowner is not responsible for the injuries of an independent subcontractor subject to exceptions, this case does not present the best record to do that. Those cases exist. Those two cases have been out there for 30 years, moving along parallel universes. And doing it on these facts with so little record available as to the kind of things that would inform a duty in the way that Laszlo suggests, my respectful suggestion is that this is just not the right case to do that. But if your honors are inclined to do it, I would urge you to look at, although ordinarily, as I said, you would say you shouldn't consider them, at least the facts of some of these other unreported cases that have been urged upon the court to see how fact-sensitive the relationship is, including how many contractors, what type of work, what they're doing, what the contract says, all those kinds of things, none of which is provided in any record that would allow you to make the kind of determination that I believe this court was seeking to make. Thank you for your patience with the argument and your time and attention.
Mr. Rocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I think the clear trajectory of this court's precedents is that the general negligence test governs the inquiry into the existence and the scope of a general contractor's duty of care. Now, I'm not equipped here as an amicus to comment on the record and to conduct a labeling exercise like my friends have done as to who exactly is the general contractor or the developer or what have you. But Justice Wainwright and Justice Hoffman, I think this gets to your question as to one of the virtues of the general negligence test that was set forth in Carvalho and in Holloway is that labeling exercise doesn't matter all that much at the end of the day, because it is a principled and fact-sensitive and functional test. And I think one of the ways that the court could write this opinion is to say that, well, whatever label we apply to the quote-unquote general contractor or the developer here, it doesn't really matter all that much because the factors are just not there to impose a duty on the defendant. I'd like to make a brief point about—
Just a quick question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Refer to the general negligence test. You're talking about the Holloway test?
Yeah, so I think it actually started in Carvalho, Justice Patterson. That was in 1996. Holloway, I think, was in 1999. Holloway, I think, is—
gotten to be known as the Holloway test.
Right, the Holloway test, whatever. Yeah. I mean, it probably started in Hopkins, the four-factor mm-hmm. test that's set forth there. What Carvalho and Holloway did is just apply the four factors and the general negligence inquiry into the duty of care in a construction site safety case. One point that I think is important to highlight at the outset here is that a general contractor can have overall responsibility at a job site, including overarching responsibility over site safety, and yet not be responsible for every unsafe thing that happens at a job site. I mean, that was the case in Tarabokia. I think it's the clear implication of this court's precedents, because otherwise it would be a meaningless exercise to go through everything that Holloway and Carvalho did. Why would we even analyze a general contractor's duty of care, the existence or scope of it, if liability is just going to be imposed on a general contractor no matter what? I think to just reply to some of my friend's arguments about the applicability of OSHA, I mean, OSHA is relevant for sure. But a general contractor's duty is not commensurate with OSHA. This court made that clear.
Are you disagreeing with NYNJ Link, which seemed to be arguing that OSHA, the provisions that petitioner was citing, are completely irrelevant to a private construction case, and the provision that I read only applies to federally funded projects, which this was not?
I took my friend's argument for the developer to be saying that OSHA does not dictate the standard of care that a general contractor has at a job site.
I must have misunderstood then, because I thought that your friend was arguing that the provision of OSHA that I read is not relevant in private contracting cases and is only relevant in federally funded contracting
cases. What I would say is the relevance of OSHA is something that has to be elucidated at a particular job site by experts. I mean, that's not something that I'm aware of that's been done here. That was one of the things that this court held in Fernandez versus Dar, that construction site safety cases are sort of the equivalent of medical malpractice cases, where it's not within the ordinary average knowledge of a juror to say when OSHA applies or when it doesn't apply. I mean, there can be debate about when a certain provision in OSHA applies and how it provides. My point is this, is that a general contractor's duty of care is not commensurate with OSHA, whatever OSHA says, because the court has shied away from the regulatory analysis of these types of cases. And OSHA can be relevant, it may not be relevant, but one of the things that I don't think that the court should do is reject one categorical approach that's in the old line of cases, Mavrikaitis, the Wolzak standard, and apply Holloway and Carvalho to this analysis here, and then just replace it with another categorical approach, which is to say that, well, OSHA says or doesn't say that a general contractor has a non-delegable duty, and therefore, just based on the status of a general contractor, we're going to hold that they have a duty of care in every instance. What I think, when the rubber meets the road in these cases, and this is what we tried to do in our brief with the general negligence test and the traditional common law test, is the elements of control and foreseeability are really paramount. They're distinct, to be sure, but there's also some overlap. I mean, the more control that a general contractor exercises over an independent subcontractor, the more likely that it's going to be foreseeable when a harm befalls the independent subcontractor's employee. That was what happened in the Holloway case. Whatever the labels that are applied there, what happened was the general contractor that hired the independent sub controlled certain means and methods of the subcontractor's work.
So are you asking us to go with the common law test, go with the Holloway or Carvalho test, or go with some separate test that you say is kind of a combination of the two.
What I think I'm saying is the general negligence test, which is Alloway and Carvalho, should be the test that governs here. But it should be informed by the traditional common law test. I hate to use the term common law because they're both common law, but the traditional common law test as opposed to the more modern general negligence test. And the best way to do that is to look at the Tarabokia decision. That was an appellate division case, 2012, where the analysis was replied thoroughly and rigorously there. What I would say, that case highlighted the issue of control. Alloway highlighted the issue of control. And what I think is relevant in those cases is that we don't want to live in a world in construction site injury where sort of everything is relevant, but nothing is dispositive. I mean, if you have a general contractor that's exercising specific control, not overarching control over like making sure that the work happens on time, but specific control over a subcontractor's means and methods, well, then that's going to be a pretty dispositive factor under which a trial judge can confidently deny a motion for summary judgment and send the issue to the jury to determine whether or not that there is a breach. In the same way, like this is what happened in Tarabokia, the general contractor did not exercise specific control over the independent subcontractor. And the kinds of questions that are going to be relevant there are, who was the equipment provided by? Was the general contractor on site at the time? Had there ever been an issue with this particular subcontractor? Was the work that the subcontractor was doing within the expertise of the general contractor? Because that's one of the reasons that general contractors will hire independent subcontractors, because they don't know how to do the specific work. And if it's objectively reasonable for the general contractor to rely on the independent subcontractor, absent some other area of control, well, then that's a factor under which a trial judge can confidently grant summary judgment to the general contractor. I think one concern over focusing on control, and this is where the foreseeability aspect of the test comes in, is that what we don't want is for general contractors, and obviously this isn't what happened here, is for a general contractor to sort of say, you know what, here are the keys to the job site. We're going to stick our head in the sand and we're just not going to exercise any control, because if something happens that's unsafe, you know, then we're going to be held responsible for it. And this, Justice Wainwright, is the Carvalho case. Control, I don't take that case to be that control was the paramount factor there. It was a factor to be sure, but really what the court focused on there was foreseeability. The foreseeability of the harm. The engineer did not have specific control over the subcontractor who tragically died's work. But what the court highlighted there was it was certainly foreseeable to that engineer that something could have gone wrong with this trench that ultimately led to the plaintiff's death, because just a few days before this trench collapsing, there was another trench that collapsed. So that's an example of foreseeability that just can come up in absent the element of control. One of the things that I think the traditional common law test does, even though the court is not going to extend that line of cases any further, I don't think. I mean, I don't take anybody to be asking the court to overrule that line of cases, but your honors can make clear that the general negligence test does govern. There are helpful elements of the three exceptions to the traditional common law test. The control element is one that we've talked about. The other two exceptions are, I think, relevant. One is the hiring of an incompetent contractor, and the other is negligence nuisance per se. Something is inherently dangerous. And what I would say is about the second exception, the hiring of an incompetent contractor, the way I think that will manifest itself and sort of is baked into the analysis is by the element of foreseeability. Was it foreseeable to the general contractor that in hiring this specific sub, there was going to be an issue with any aspect of the sub's work? And that can encompass any number of things. It's going to be a very fact-sensitive and specific analysis. Were there other OSHA violations? Did this general contractor have a relationship with this subcontractor on other job sites that would have led it to believe that it could not do this work safely? The other thing I will say is that exception, I've seen plaintiff's attorneys do this. They'll simply bring a negligent hiring count in addition to the negligence count, so it could also be hired that way. But what I would say about foreseeability also applies to this inherently dangerous element of a construction site, because one of the knocks, I guess, on the Tarabokia decision is that what the plaintiff was doing in that case was not really that dangerous. But I mean, I sit behind a desk all day, and like everything that happens on a construction site sort of seems dangerous to me. I mean, the plaintiff in Tarabokia was using a gunpowder activated tool to bolt anchors into a wall, right? Like that seems dangerous. Anything on a construction site can be dangerous. The question is not, is this thing dangerous? The question is, did the general contractor have reason to foresee that in doing this specific task, the subcontractor was not going to be able to complete it safely? So a subcontractor could be hired to install roofing or scaffolding on a work site. The question is not, is working at a height dangerous? Of course it's dangerous. The question is, was there anything that led the subcontractor to believe through something that happened on a job site, through a corrective order that was given at the job site, whatever may be, that subcontractor was not going to be able to perform their scope of work safely? I'll just close, and I'm happy to answer any questions that your honors may have, by saying that I think that what we're asking for is not really that radical. I mean, Tara Boccia has been on the books since 2012 for almost 15 years. It's a very thorough and well-reasoned case. I think it helpfully combines these two tests that we've been talking about. And like, you know, the place hasn't fallen apart, right? These claims can still be brought and they can still be defended. And there will be cases when summary judgment is appropriate and there will be cases when it's not. It's going to depend on the factual scenario. I do take the position that's being advocated by the petitioner to be a radical one, which is to say that in every instance, simply because of a contractor's status as a general contractor, that general contractor is going to bear liability as a matter of law. That would be a profound departure from this court's precedents and jurisprudence. And the court should certainly not extend the duty in this case here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Confucione, I know we talked about doing rebuttal in less than 5 minutes, and I understand in light of the argument it may
take,
a bit more than that. And
quite brief, Your Honor. I must tip my hat to the amicus's argument. It was very, very helpful.
Could you start by addressing the question that we've spent a good deal of time on today, and that is whether your client was a general contractor, a subcontractor, something else?
Yeah, I think that I would just say to point to the record at A581 to 85, it's not really so much the label as I think the court has noted. It's really the relationship between the parties. I understand that a general contractor in the general definition is one who's actively involved in the construction project. A developer, by contrast, is more like the underlying entities of Link, which are just, we finance stuff and otherwise had nothing to do with it. If you look at the testimony of the CEO and the deposition, it shows that they were sufficiently actively engaged in the construction project to qualify as essentially, quote, the, you know, general contractor.
Well, are you saying that you're referring to the developer?
Yeah. So if you look at, so to me, the developer, even though it's labeled as a developer, with vis-a-vis the KWM entity, the general contractor in that relationship is Link.
We have a cert grant based upon the question whether a general contractor is liable under these circumstances. Right. What is your position as to whether or not Mr. Mergner's client is a general contractor?
It is the general contractor.
It is
the general contractor. And if you look at, again, the 581 to 85 testimony of the CEO, that testimony that he said there, and I, as a matter of time, I don't want to go into it in detail.
Is it correct that regardless of that testimony, your client took a different position before the trial court and the court of appeals? In that, before the trial court and the court of appeals, your client was not arguing that Link was the general contractor and your client was the subcontractor? I'm sorry, not your client, KWM. I phrased that incorrectly. Before the trial court and the appellate division, did you say that Link is the general contractor and KWM was the subcontractor? Or did you not say that?
No, that argument was made. And in fact, the judge's opinion below is premised on that Link, as the general contractor, did not owe a duty to KWM. And again, I think the label that's put on it at a developer is not what really controls. It's more the facts of the specific case. And the facts in this case are what the CEO said. Those are the most significant. And he talked about, they asked him at one point, I think it's maybe on 582, they said, was it just KWM that hired everybody? He said, no, we both did the work. They had some direct people on the project. So this is not just in the role of, quote, developer in the way that my adversary says, in terms of, like, they had no involvement in this construction. They clearly did.
Isn't Alloway about general contractor versus subcontractor?
Yes.
And
isn't Carvalho the same? General contractor versus subcontractor.
I think Carvalho was more about this. I think that's the case with the project engineer. And the other thing, I guess I would say this, Your Honor, is I think ultimately the alloy factor analysis applies no matter the label. Because even if you look at some of the other cases the court has said, and the appellate division has definitely addressed, sometimes even a landowner can be deemed the, quote, general contractor.
And what I'm focused on here is the question that was framed at the outset of this appeal.
No, I think the question still applies. It's the same thing, because you said, what does a general contractor owe to a subcontractor's employees? And I'm still saying the record in this case shows that Link is the, quote, general contractor, despite the label it puts on itself. It acted as the general contractor under the understanding of New Jersey law, which is that it was actively involved in the construction project. So from that standpoint, the question still remains. And then the only other thing I would say is, I mean, the alloy factor analysis, if I understand the amicus argument, I think that the court should just say that's the analysis that applies as it does in all other negligence cases. And I do think that it should at least clarify that the old general common law test with the three exceptions is not a standalone test. I think the amicus is right that, for example, how much control they had in the way the subcontractor did the work certainly is a factor in the under the alloy test, but it's not a separate test, in other words. I think that's been too confusing for the lower courts. And then finally, on the OSHA, I think the court should just stick to alloy with regard to the OSHA. It talked about OSHA regulations are important. They're not a per se thing.
Are you agreeing with your opposing counsel that the OSHA provisions that you cited do not actually apply here because they only apply to federally funded construction projects, and this is not a federally funded construction project?
No, I don't agree with that. And even if that was technically true, which I don't think that it is, it doesn't detract from the court statement that OSHA regulations in general are an important factor in whether there should be a duty imposed.
And if the OSHA regulations that say that the duty is always on the general contractor and it's non-delegable don't apply, then OSHA regulations might be very relevant, but there are none in this case that apply in this circumstance.
If
the only ones that you're presenting only apply in the case of federally funded construction, which this is not.
I've never seen that in any case, including in the alloy case. I mean, the court didn't make that
decision.
What
about in the OSHA regs themselves?
If the OSHA regs say, for example,
only subsection 1 applies if it's federally funded, mm-hmm. and then only subsections 2 and 3 apply if it's not federally funded.
Yeah.
You're saying we should just ignore that and go ahead and apply section 1, even if it's not federally funded?
I think New Jersey regulatory law is no different. I don't think there's any kind of regulatory law that says, and first of all, the fact that a federal regulation wouldn't apply in this case seems a little odd since it's a two-state Gothels Bridge project. I'm not really sure how federal law wouldn't apply in that circumstance.
No, but OSHA doesn't. Does OSHA have certain sections that apply into certain categories of projects?
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay, so doesn't it matter whether this is in or out for purposes of your argument, which was based in part on OSHA, a violation of OSHA regulations?
Yeah, I think it matters. It matters, but I don't think
our case law, for example, that says that OSHA requirements are relevant. That's only the requirements OSHA sets forth. That's not requirements that don't exist under OSHA, right?
No, I agree with that.
So if OSHA is not requiring a particular thing, then that would no longer be relevant.
I agree with you on that. I just don't think that's the correct conclusion. And I also think that this theme of the modern regulatory scheme where a general contractor is not supposed to be able to, you know, it's supposed to be a non-delegable duty. I think I've seen that beyond just mere federal OSHA construction projects. I've seen that generally around the country, including in this court. The only other thing I would say is, I think there will be some questions, even if the court adopts the alloy factor analysis. There will be some cases, I think, where the question of the duty, even though it's for the court, there may be some factual disputes in a case where the duty question can't really be definitively answered by the judge. So there are factual issues that have to be addressed first. Unless the court has any other questions, I would rest on that.
Thank you, and thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.